Thank you, Alan. Before we get started today, and while people are filing in, are there loose ends that you'd like to talk about? Sometimes overnight, you have a dream, or in the individual groups, issues come up that weren't handled, or things occur. There'll be time for discussion during the plenary today, but I wanted to just make a little room at the beginning here for any issues that you felt were not covered with a bias, left confused, unfinished, might tie up some loose ends here this morning. And please go to the mic if you wouldn't mind.
I was thinking about the combined factors of the split off spiritual part that is attempting to protect one, and the accelerated intuition that trauma survivors sometimes have. But I was also thinking about how that split off part, in its desire to protect one, isn't necessarily acting in one's own best interest. So how does one learn whether or not one can trust that accelerated intuition, like whether it's coming from the split-off part that's antenna is so long that anything that vibrates like the original trauma is to be gotten out of? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's a real discernment problem.
It's discernment of the spirits. But just to reiterate what you said in the beginning of your question, I am trying to describe how when the psyche divides, and all of our psyches divide just under the reality contact that occurs, but in trauma it happens in a particularly dramatic way, one part of the self regresses, and I'm calling that the soul part. It's usually represented in the inner world and oftentimes in dreams as a child, sometimes an injured child, sometimes a child in hiding, sometimes a child that's sick, sometimes a child that has extraordinary capacities, like an early psychoanalytic investigator named Sandor Ferenczi kept finding dreams of what he called the wise baby. And what he meant by those dreams of the wise baby was that in dreams of his clients, a child appeared and seemed to speak before it was 6 months old or to have great wisdom. And that's the soul child. That's the representation of that spark that has gone into hiding. Now, the part that continues in life, Winnicott called the false self, but it's not really a false self. It's what I call the self-care system. It's an ego that's built on certain capacities, often of the mind. You mentioned intuition. Winnicott said the false self always goes into the mind, because the mind can transcend the body and transcend the limitations of the body. So the mind then becomes a voice of control. And the defensive system that organizes around that splitting and keeps us in being as a mental structure is frequently a patriarchal mental structure. It's frequently the old mind in fairy tales. It's the old king or the old order. And its best intentions are to help us survive as personalities in a world that doesn't make room for the lost soul child. And so we get then a kind of rigid ego structure, very identified with certain stories, certain structures, certain understandings, certain rigidities. We become very self-sufficient. We become very independent. We become very armored. We can't let in then that those broken places and those injured places, which are where the soul comes back. I love the image that was used this morning in worship about a road of truth on which the soul can return. That's it. But you see, the truth is the whole truth and nothing but the truth. The whole truth is all the parts of the psyche, all the parts of the human personality, everything together, not the head ego with its organizing, controlling mind, self-sufficient, tough, armored. That's only part of the self. But the lost heart of the self that longs for reunion with the rest, that's the part that we're talking about here, and that's the part that's outpictured in these fairy tales. So how do you tell the message then from that part that's in hiding, from the message that that the mind gives you? I'll just give you this because it comes off the top of my head. One indication of when you're in touch with that soul child is when you are moved. Whenever you are moved by something that surprises you, or a moment of beauty, a moment of intimacy, a moment of in nature. When you're moved, the soul is returning on that road of truth. You're having a little glimpse of your own wholeness. And so that's a place where that small spirit inside you or inside us joins the larger spirit of truth, of life, of God in that moment. And we all know those moments. Yeah. Yes.
One of the things that really struck me in a lot of the stories of parenting infants in particular, but even with young children, is how often it's discounted that the father can be a very nurturing and warm vehicle for the child to know itself, as well as the mother, and that can really be a balancing aspect to a child learning to know itself, that a father can be as nurturing as a mother, as motherly as a mother.
Absolutely. That's so true. And, you know, there's finally starting to be some evidence now in the psychological literature of just how crucial fathers are in the process of the development of children. Mothers have always borne the terrible brunt in psychoanalytic theorizing of, you know, all the credit and all the blame. And it's as if, you know, we've been completely preoccupied with the mother. D.W. Winnicott, who was a British writer and one of those who really emphasized the tremendous importance of the mother-infant bond, had a total preoccupation with the mother. And he got a hold of Jung's autobiography. I'm just telling this to illustrate the preoccupation with mothers. And he read Jung's autobiography, and then in that autobiography, Jung talks about his number one and his number two personalities. His number one personality is what I'm calling the self-care system or the head ego. It was adapted to the world. It was striving. It was ambitious. It accomplished all kinds of things. He did with it in control. But his number two personality, he considered in touch with God's world. That was his soul life. That was his number two personality. And Winnicott got a hold of that and also read that Jung was suspicious of the word love ever since his parents separated when he was very young. And then the final thing that cemented it for Winnicott as he reviewed this book was that Jung's first memory was of lying in his pram and looking up at the dappled light coming through the leaves of a beautiful tree over his pram and feeling this indescribable sense of bliss. Winnicott's only way of relating to Jung's autobiography was to say that he was a childhood schizophrenic. And because he had a split personality, and that his first memory, says Winnicott, to prove it all, was not of his mother. Okay? Now you see, there's the fantasy that psychoanalysis has that there's nothing that happens except in the relationship between the infant and the mother. There's no great mother. There's no archetypal mother. There's no experience in the world that could ever substitute for that. And of course, we know that, you know, disturbances in the primal relationship with the mother or the caretaker, the mothering father, or the significant parenting figure, if there are deep injuries in that or terrible neglect, we do know that it makes for severe difficulties later. And in precisely the ways in which I'm saying, a part of the self goes into hiding. And because it can't reach, it can't be registered, it can't be recognized. And but there's much more going on in the inner world than Winnicott ever gave us to understand. And this is why I think so much of contemporary psychoanalysis needs to be supplemented by depth psychological orientation. So fathers are crucial.
Good. Thank you. Something I just want to clarify from yesterday. You talked about, and I don't know totally what kind of, you're talking about contrasexual elements.
Contrasexual elements, yes.
Yes, and you pointedly said heterosexual, and I wondered what you meant by that.
Well, here we're still hung up by the opposites, you see, and I'll tell you what the classical Jungian theory is and was, because this is now being revisioned. Mm-hmm. Classical Jungian theory is that for men, the soul image is carried by women, by the feminine. So when a man falls in love with a girl, he's projecting his own soul image onto her and falling in love with his own soul. It's the ego's relationship to the soul. So that's the classical Jungian understanding. Similarly, with a woman tends to project her soul image onto the masculine, and so that when a woman falls in love, she's falling in love with the soul image projected into the man that she finds attractive. Now, that understanding has been found very offensive, particularly to the gay community, because many homosexual men have written, sort of revisioning Jung's theory, that their soul image happened to be male. And that when they fell in love, they found that their soul image was carried by a man. Similarly, in the lesbian community, the same thing's been said. So, I don't think Jung's early structure necessarily holds up. You see, and we're stuck in these stereotypes because even to say that a gay or lesbian individual projects the same sex image as a soul image is a straitjacket. And so it doesn't feel adequate anymore. And what's missing in this all of this is the person.